Fleur released the hem of the dress she was preparing to baste and pushed the needle back into the pincushion she wore on her wrist. "We're on speaking terms again?" She looked up to find her daughter leaning against the doorframe, her long hair piled up on her head.
"I'm good with the arrangement if you are."
Fleur gazed at her daughter and found herself suddenly awash in ambivalent feelings that had little to do with Lucy or the holes her sharp tongue had poked in Fleur's heart.
"You're still mad?"
"No," Fleur said, then rethought. "Well, yes, I am a little, but it isn't that. It's only with your hair up like that, you look so much like your grandmother, Lore." It was to be expected that blood would tell that Lucy should resemble Fleur's own mother, but here, in her mother's house, in her mother's favorite room, Fleur knew it was more than that. Her mother had at last found a way to haunt her. Lucy tugged the clip from her hair and shook her hair out.
"Oh, great. I look like the lunatic."
"Please don't call her that." Fleur felt her cheeks flush, but she couldn't decide if the heat was sparked by an offended sense of decorum or shame. Perhaps she had tapped into the dregs of her filial loyalty.
"I'm sorry," Lucy said, and Fleur recognized true regret in her voice.
Her daughter dropped her hair clip on a side table and drew closer. She laid a hand on Fleur's shoulder.
"I didn't mean it. Well, I did, but I didn't mean to hurt you. Do you ever worry it might run in the family, the mental illness thing? Sometimes I worry that maybe it's in me too."
Fleur felt a flash of anger meet a long repressed sense of abandonment. "Your grandmother's condition was not hereditary. She brought it on herself." Fleur patted Lucy's hand. "She chose it. You do share much with your grandmother, but you do not share her madness."
"Like what?"
"Well, to start, your grandmother was a legendary beauty. Fiery and independent, I've been told, when she was young. She was spirited like you, but unlike you, she was selfish and incapable of saying those two little words. I'm sorry. You've gotten the best parts of her. Be glad of that. And keep a guard against her less enviable characteristics." Her daughter's face took on an inscrutable look.
"But I'm a lot like you too, right?"
In spite of all the to-be-expected teenage rebellion and the entitled hellfire Lucy had let loose last night, Fleur sensed her daughter did in fact admire her. Lucy needed to feel she reflected the best of her mother. Ironic, really, as Fleur turned to her daughter for proof of her own worth. "I see your open heart and hope that came from me." She rose and leaned in for a quick hug, then stepped back.
"Enough."
She nodded at her work. "Let's have it, then. What do you think of the dress?" She had tried to sound playful, but in truth she was afraid of Lucy's opinion, terrified it would echo Lore's patronizing dismissal of the drawings Fleur had shown her years ago, back when she first told her she wanted to study design.
"Tu es bien un courtier doué, mais la modelise, c'est la quête de son d'originalité. Toi, ma jolie chanton, tu es un pastiches."
"My mother," Fleur dared, "thought me to be an excellent seamstress, but found my designs too derivative of the works of others. She called me a pastiches, a hopeless imitator."
"Yeah. This from the woman who thought the 80s was a good opportunity to retrofit her mothballed Cassinis with shoulder pads."
Lucy held up a hand.
"Don't bother defending her. I've seen the photos."
A tiny smile curled up on Fleur's lips as Lucy took a few steps backward, studying the dress first from a distance, then spiraled in on it,
judging it from every angle.
Not terrible, she said, her tone signaling the approval she couldn't bring herself to convey directly. She touched the bodice. Silk, V-neckline and back, deep enough to be alluring, but with enough coverage to pass as demure. She circled around once more. High waist seam, but not too high. Gives the illusion of an hourglass figure. Her hand dropped to the skirt. Tulle. Nice geometric cutouts.
Oh, hand-sewn. Genuine couture.
She paused to offer an appreciative nod that was only tinged with the mildest sarcasm. A-line ankle length. Perfect for an afternoon high tea or a wicker man torching. She paused for a quick, self-satisfied smile. The black is a tad severe, but overall not bad. Floor took this as a grade of A. I might even wear it. No, A plus. The right shoes could make it work. A summary statement to make it clear Floor shouldn't let one success go to her head. Floor realized she'd been holding her breath. She exhaled, grateful and relieved. I'm happy it passes muster, if only by a hair. I designed it for you, for tonight. She brushed back her daughter's bangs. Tell me you really love it, because I haven't slept a wink. Lucy began, sounding a bit reticent.
I do. Love it, really.
But Lucy wasn't even looking at the dress. Instead, she drifted over to Flora's ersatz desk. She circled around it, examining the drawings and fabric samples littering its surface. She paused and picked up the large round Milfiori paperweight Flora had taken from Celestin's study. This she carried with her as she returned to Flora's side. I brought that back from Italy as a souvenir for Celestin. It's called Milfiori. She gave a slight nod at the globe in her daughter's hand. That's why I chose it for father. He was once fond of saying he wished he had 1,000 little flowers just like me. She smiled at the sentiment. Perhaps at one time Celestin had been capable of love. I was only 4 or so, but I remember the trip well. Mother, Vincent, and I. She paused to reflect. I don't remember why Father and Nicholas stayed home. She shrugged. We were in Rome, she said and laughed. All I remember from Rome was ice cream and the Trevi Fountain. But Venice, there is no forgetting Venice.
Remy broke up with me.
Floor couldn't hide her surprise. She shook her head to signal her confusion and opened her mouth to speak.
The day after Thanksgiving, Lucy continued. Not a big surprise.
I'm sorry. I wish you would have come to me. Lucy began, then fell silent.
You were already having to deal with Dad.
She shrugged. Flora felt like a total failure as a parent. I'm sorry, she said. I'm sorry I wasn't there for you. There was something else. She could almost hear the wheels spinning in her daughter's mind. What happened?
Nothing, she said, sighing. He got all weird after his mom's stroke, that's all.
Weird how?
At first I thought Remy was blaming me. Well, you, for what happened to Mrs. Perot. He had started filling in for his mom at her shop. He and his granddad, even though Remy swore Mr. Simeon hates the place.
Alcide is certainly no fan of the Marin family, that's certain, but
can you blame him?
Fleur shook her head. She couldn't blame him. In fact, she had wondered at the expert-level parental aplomb with which Lisette had accepted, or at least pretended to accept,
her son's relationship with Lucy. Flora could only hope her own performance had been equally convincing.
Yeah, Lucy continued. I know what you're thinking. But Remy and I both knew what you and his mom were up to, making nice even though you'd both rather chew off your arms than see us together.
I have nothing against Remy, but anyone could see you two would have a difficult path to tread, given that
my grandma murdered his.
Yeah, I get it. I'm not stupid. She looked away, the way she did when she felt ashamed.
I wasn't sorry he did it. I was relieved. I was only 15 when I met him. Not gonna lie, it was the Shakespearean forbidden romance aspect of it that first attracted me to him. It didn't seem like it would be long term. Then you said we were staying, and I was kind of stuck in it. I wanted to want him. I wanted to love him even. But I didn't. She focused on Floor. A person can change a lot in 2 years. She spoke as if conveying a nearly unfathomable truth. Floor spared Lucy the condescension of adding, especially at your age, to Lucy's thought. Instead, she nodded in agreement.
It doesn't bother me he broke up with me. What bothers me is the way he looked at me. Like he was looking through me and seeing something wrong.
Flora blanched. There is nothing wrong with you.
Lucy lifted her chin and looked down her nose at Flora, the expression betraying her doubt. Had Lucy begun to sense something? Was it possible she had begun to realize her time on this earth had been borrowed, stolen from another?
I've been thinking, Lucy began, then fell silent, biting her lower lip, focusing on the paperweight, as if it were a religious icon.
Yes, Flora prompted her, even as she knelt again before the dress, turning her attention back to the tool.
I'm old enough to make up my own mind about the wedding. I'm going. And I won't be coming back to New Orleans.
Flora froze. At first, a surprised, wounded, oh, was all she could muster. She looked up at Lucy.
What do you mean you aren't coming back?
I mean, I'm staying in D.C.
Flora's face flushed hot. Lucy had conspired with her father, who had gone along with her plan, because he was too weak to speak the truth, knowing it would fall on Flora to act as the disciplinarian. The foolish coward. He knew it was impossible. He knew what Flora was up against trying to keep their daughter alive.
Perhaps, she allowed her fear to flame into a wounded anger. We should call your father together and discuss this little plan you've been cooking up. He can clarify whether the party invitation includes an offer to stay on indefinitely. Trust me, he doesn't want you horning in on his new life, at least not for long. And even if he does, I guarantee you young Meredith doesn't. Her words came out sharp. This, she thought, this is how Warren repays me for giving him his freedom without fanfare.
I don't plan to horn in on Dad or either one of his fetuses, Lucy said, crossing her arms and beginning to cry. I spoke to Haley last night.
This didn't surprise Flora. The two had been friends since preschool. If Lucy wanted to complain to someone about her terrible mother, Haley would be the most likely choice.
To her parents, too. They said I could stay with them.
She brushed away her tears.
I don't want to leave you, Mom, but I want to go home. I want to finish school with my friends.
Of course. Flora realized how selfish she must appear to Lucy. Flora had insisted on remaining here long past the point any reasonable woman would. She had blamed her decision to stay on the pole of home, joked she was less intimidated by bloodthirsty bayou witches seeking revenge on Celestin's kin than she was by the backbiting Potomac bitches waiting for her in what she and Lucy had come to call the real world. But for them, for both of them, New Orleans was the real world now. The only world where Fleur felt any confidence in her ability to keep her daughter alive. Lucy couldn't learn the real reason they needed to remain in New Orleans. Fleur had felt the need to return to her source, sensing her magic would hold out the longest, remain the strongest here in the city of her birth. Someday, long after Fleur had found a lasting solution, Lucy might learn everything Fleur did. Everything was for her. Until then, she might have to let her daughter hate her. I want to go home. I need to go home. We haven't been gone 6 months and already everyone's forgotten me. They're ghosting me. Not because they're mad at me, but because I don't exist. Fleur understood. Her own DC friends had taken to returning her texts a day or two late, if at all. She hadn't believed her world could move on so easily without her, but it had, almost like she had never belonged in it.
I'm sorry, ma chère, but this...
She motioned around the oval room, though she meant to imply New Orleans.
Is our home now.
Maybe this is your home, but it never was mine. It never will be. Fleur had realized all along Lucy was keeping one foot out the door, resisting making new connections other than to Remy. She had hoped a sense of family would give Lucy enough gravity to keep her happy. I'm an adult. Almost.
Fleur shook her head. You are still a minor. Your father and I agreed. Your place is with me. She felt a flash of inspiration.
I was planning to capitulate to your wish to attend your father's wedding, she lied. But I can't now. You will not be returning to DC. At least not before your 18th birthday. That tack could at most only buy Fleur 7 months. I know you're angry with Daddy, embarrassed about his affair, but you're Fleur frickin' Marin. Fleur recognized the progression of Lucy's campaign. A full-on frontal attack was failing, so she was moving on to stage two, flattery. It's been months now. You should rise like a phoenix from the Endicott ashes and carry us back to civilization on first class, if not private wings. But instead, you're here building a nest out of paint strips and fabric swatches, getting ready to put a new face on the old Marin mausoleum. You deserve more than this.
I said no.
She braced herself for the knife. God, you can be such a bitch. No wonder Daddy started banging Meredith. No wonder Eli is hiding from you.
Lucy's last-ditch effort. Cruelty.
Your life might be over, but that doesn't mean mine has to be.
There it was. The brilliant summation intended to knock the fight out of Fleur. It succeeded in bringing tears to her eyes, but Fleur was prepared to fight to her last breath for Lucy, even if that fight was with Lucy. She stood and took the paperweight from Lucy's hand.
I realize you're disappointed, she said, angry with me, but I hope you know how much I do love you.
Lucy snorted at her words.
Right. She began to search Lucy's eyes, trying to gauge how long it would be before the storm passed. A couple of days, maybe a week. A chill began to tickle the base of her spine. Something was wrong. Lucy was there, with her, walking, talking, breathing, but something, some vital spark was missing. The thing that had made her Lucy was gone. Her beloved Lucy was already dead. Fleur stumbled backward from shock and fell to the floor, dropping the paperweight. It bounced on the rug and rolled to a stop at Lucy's feet.
I'm okay. I'm okay, she said reflexively, as she pushed herself up onto her elbows.
Lucy didn't respond. Instead, she bent over and picked up the paperweight. She came closer and dropped to her knees beside Fleur.
Your life might be over, but mine doesn't have to be.
Fleur saw a bright streak as Lucy brought the heavy glass globe down on her forehead once, then again. Then all fell to darkness. 23.
Here? Evangeline said, incredulity playing in her voice as she held out her hands and turned as if trying to take in the whole of the city and not just the festooned square around them.
New Orleans is where magic will be reborn?
It will certainly die here, Marceline shrugged. But whether it will be reborn is yet to be decided. I can assure you New Orleans was molded from inception for this very purpose.
Molded by whom? Alice said.
The why was obvious, the how, no doubt, arcane. The agency seemed the loosest thread to pull.
An excellent question, Marceline said. The arch of her eyebrow and her conspiratorial tone caused Alice to abandon hope for a concise answer.
You will indulge me in a brief history lesson, yes?
Evangeline cast Alice a nervous glance. She seemed worried the reborn sorceress would push Alice to the limits of her patience, perhaps because she herself was losing patience. Alice gave Evangeline a nod to reassure her, then turned to Marceline and said,
Of course.
It might take Alice years to sort through the facts and fictions of Marceline's story, but she could overlook a little dishonesty if it meant hearing the history of the city from a woman who had lived most of it. Marceline's face brightened with what struck Alice as true pleasure. The old witch, Alice realized, was lonely. This was her chance to reminisce.
One might, Marceline said, diving into her ruminations. Look to Dupaget, the despotic little bureaucrat who drew up the plan of the Vieux Carré. Celui-là, il était un vrai zob.
She leaned in toward Alice, her smooth brow furrowing.
Do you know he pulled down a man's house so he could superimpose his new grid system? When the poor fellow complained, Dupaget imprisoned him in darkness with shackles around his ankles. The man was nearly blind by the time he was released. But then again, Dupaget was a draftsman, not an artist. And all witches are, at least to a small degree, artists. I believe we must move a bit farther afield, all the way back to France, if we are to discover the spider at the center of this web. The man after whom the city was named, Le Duc d'Orléans, or, as I like to think of him, Philippe le Brunelleur. He was the regent of France between the death of Louis XIV and when Louis XV reached his maturity at the ripe old age of 13.
At the mention of the Bourbon kings, Alice's mind flashed back to her first impression of the Dreaming Road, a facsimile of Versailles' Galerie de Glace. Had Alice's interpretation of the Dreaming Road as Louis XIV's famed Hall of Mirrors been a clue to the Dreaming Road's origin, a marker of its DNA?
No, Marceline continued to muse. Philippe was not a mastermind. He was a tool.
She chuckled at her own choice of words, an accidental pun on the French, zob.
But, she held up a hand as if to fend off a protest, a useful tool all the same. as he does bring us one step closer to Françoise Marie, La Branlure's wife and cousin. She winked at Alice. Even the branches of the Marin family tree aren't nearly as twisted as those of the late French aristocracy. Alice felt Evangeline tense by her side. She held out her hand to reassure her all was well. She was a drunken hellcat, a Françoise, Marceline carried on, seemingly oblivious to the fact her last quip could have indeed been her last. Her thought of a husband made a habit of referring to her as Madame Lucifer. It seemed that name was on the tip of everyone's tongue. A pleasing coincidence, as she was, in fact, the daughter of the Sun King. Marceline paused, as if giving Alice and Evangeline a chance to make the connection. Alice got the link immediately, the message of Art's sermon feeling a tad too pertinent to Marceline's history lesson for her comfort. Sun King? Lucifer? No? Marceline shrugged when neither reacted. Françoise Marie's mother, she continued, was Louis's headmistress. No, that doesn't sound right. Her head tilted to the side. Maître Santita? She posed the question to them both, but it was Alice who responded. Official mistress. Yes, his official mistress, Madame de Montespan, who celebrated many a black mass with the sorceress known as La Voisin, and Abbé Étienne Guibord. She nodded at Alice. You might despise me, but in comparison to those three? Her words shifted away as her eyes fell to the ground. I have never harmed a child. She looked back up, her brow furrowing and her eyes set in preparation to take on any challenge from them. Then her features softened in a flash, and she turned to face Evangeline. Other than you, ma chère. For the briefest moment, Alice felt Marceline stood on the verge of begging forgiveness and Evangeline on the edge of granting it. But the silence held, the urgency in their eyes cooled, and the moment passed. Marceline coughed, pretending to clear her throat. It's rumored, she continued, assuming a pedagogical air. Guibord introduced Madame de Montespan to the lesser key of darkness, and through her hands the tome fell to her daughter. Telmère, ta fille. Did the apple fall close to the tree? You be the judge. But the mother, de Montespan, she drew out the name. She is our Arachne, the nimble weaver at the center of the web. I have no proof to offer, but still I am sure. Two clear and seemingly contradictory thoughts hit Alice at once. Marceline was a consummate liar, and Marceline was speaking the unbridled truth. How, Alice began, can the city be used to restore magic? Through the law of correspondence, this city, at least the older parts of it, form a kind of effigy, if you will. Like the magical poupée. A voodoo doll, Evangeline said, turning oddly to Alice rather than her aunt for confirmation. Yes, Marceline responded. And no. Regardless of what the movies show us, they don't use dolls in voodoo, at least not to harm. The magic of the effigy belongs to European witches, as taught to us in the old forests by the dark man himself. It struck Alice that the wicker man Nicholas was so intent on torching during the longest night celebration, too, was an effigy. A representation of the dying solar god, a stand-in for the king of bones and ashes. She began to wonder if Nicholas was acting of his own accord, as he believed, or as another's puppet. This city, Marceline said, doing a slow turn, is like one of those dolls in the sense that any magic enacted on it will affect the corresponding target or targets it was created to symbolize. Targets? The seven gates of Guinea. Papa Legba is the first to be approached. This park and its immediate environs, they were laid out along the lines of his veve. Through Legba, one arrives at the seven gates, the seven wounds, guarded by Baron Samdi and his assistants. This area, Legba's veve, lies within a greater design, one that corresponds to the Baron's veve. Seven of the second symbol's stars equate to the gates of Guinea.
But that's just nonsense they shell out for tourists, Evangeline said.
Again, she turned to Alice, her expression incredulous. It's rumored you can find the locations of the gates by aligning the center of Samdi's veve with Canal Street. The first is in the oldest cemetery.
What is New Orleans's oldest cemetery?
St. Louis number one. Everyone knows that. Evangeline responded as if her aunt had asked her to calculate 2 plus 2.
Ah, Marceline said. But what everyone knows to be true is more often than not patently false.
St. Louis Cemetery was the work of the Spanish. There was an earlier French burial ground.
The St. Peter Street Cemetery.
Marceline motioned with both hands to either side of the cathedral. Baron Samdi's veve links the heart of New Orleans voodoo, Congo Square, to the heart of the Catholic faith. The cathedral. She turned back to them.
There are no dichotomies, only polarities.
Alice knew voodoo had been a part of New Orleans' culture from its earliest days, but decades had passed between the founding of the city and the rise of the voodoo queens.
But, she said, raising her hand to shield her eyes as she turned a full circle.
None of this makes sense.
She stopped as she again faced the statue. She jabbed a finger at Jackson.
That has only been here since around 1850 or so, and most of the quarter has burned twice since New Orleans was founded. Still, you're alleging adherence to the religion of voodoo plotted the city?
I'm saying no such thing.
She sounded almost offended.
It wasn't the acolytes of voodoo, but those who wished to attack the forces represented by their Luau.
Us, she said, pounding her fist against her chest.
The witches of New Orleans. We designed this city.
But why would you, would we, want to take on those forces?
Just as your dreaming road lies between dreaming and death, the world of spirits is like a film separating the reality we know as the common world from the realm of infinite possibility, from magic. It seeps into our world through the seven wounds.
And witches want to reopen the wounds. Marceline nodded.
They aren't separate entities, the Dark Man and Legba. They are two polarities of the same force. The one tears rifts into the fabric of our reality, the other mends them. It is our dark man who siphons the madness that is magic from the realm of pure potential, and their Legba who regulates its flow through the realm of spirit into the common world. The story of Inanna and Damuzi, the queen of heaven and the king of bones and ashes, tells us how to renew these wounds, through love or betrayal, though love creates the deepest, longest-lasting wounds. Our world has seen more than one queen and myriad kings. But your Luke can be the last sacrifice, the greatest king. He's waiting now for the both of you, a mere hair's breadth beyond the seven gates. With your help, he can return to this world. Together you can conquer the force that is strangling the flow of magic. Conquer it for all time.
I don't know, Alice said, her rational mind refusing to accept she might have been born into a living myth. Then the layout of this city, the attraction between your family and the lesser key, perhaps it is all a matter of coincidence? Marceline's lips pulled down into a frown as her eyebrows rose. She was, it appeared, incredulous at Alice's resistance. Yes, one could argue that viewpoint. Even as one can insist, it's mere coincidence the speed of light as it passes through a vacuum is echoed by the latitude of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Or, on that self-same latitude, a little girl named Alice once noticed a ray of light coming from her Tati Flor's rhinestone shoe buckle. Alice caught her breath, and Marceline gave her a sly smile. It had happened the day the levees fell, the day of Alice's first encounter with Babu Jean. Flor had projected herself into Nicholas's study, and Alice had indeed noticed the reflection of a beam of light off the buckle on Fleur's shoe. It should have been impossible, as Fleur wasn't truly there. The incident had long since passed from Alice's memory. To be reminded of it all these years later by someone who had somehow gained access to a private moment took her breath away.
Oh, ma chère fille, don't be surprised. New Orleans was groomed to act as the stage of magic, and you were groomed as well. From here to the asylum on Sinclair, to the Dreaming Road and back again, the Dark Man has watched over you ever since the day your mother dedicated you to his service. Did you really think a mere servitor spirit would be capable of freeing you unless he had the help of a greater power working behind the scenes? A few more days on the Dreaming Road, and this conversation wouldn't have been necessary. Only you weren't quite baked before your nanny came to fetch you. I suspect he wants you to choose him as an act of free will. Perhaps your doing so is a requisite of his plan. Or perhaps it simply plays to his sense of pageantry. After all, darkness has always had a penchant for the romantic gesture. Astrid dedicated me to his service? She did, but not entirely alone. Astrid worked under his guidance. He chose you, ma petite, as la pucelle du Nouvel Orléans, our new Joan of Arc. It's your destiny.
Again with the destiny. There's a big difference between fate and manipulation. Marceline laughed. Not when the entity that's pulling the strings is capable of shredding the fabric of reality. You are the maiden knight, born and bred to lead an army. An army you encountered on the Dreaming Road. The shadows, Evangeline said, turning on her, looking at Alice as if she were a dangerous stranger.
Demons, Marceline corrected her. Not the kind they.
She gave a quick nod toward the cathedral.
Talk about.
The Dreaming Road was never an escape, nor was it intended as a trap. It's a kind of factory, or perhaps refinery is the better term, that burns away a witch's humanity, leaving nothing more than a sentient, remorseless power. The Dark Man has done us a tremendous service, though. Your army might prove to be unnecessary. Through his splendid works, he has created an alternative to a great sacrifice. There is a much simpler, less devastating way to open the gates and make way for the king, if you're willing to consider it.
I'm not sure
how, Evangeline spoke over her. How can we save Luke?
The gates.
Marceline raised her hands and gestured around the square.
They are no longer out here.
She drew near and caught Alice's hand in her left, and Evangeline's in her right. She tugged them both down as she leaned in.
The Voodoo Yen, she whispered, has taken the seven wounds into herself. All you have to do to open the gates is kill the Perot woman.
24. The faces in the window popped in and out of view. One moment nothing more than a flat sigil painted on a pane. The next, an intelligence studying Alice with a level of wariness that matched her own. They, Alice sensed, were questioning her intentions for coming. Alice wondered at the same thing. The interior of the shop was dark, and a sign reading Fermé hung in the door. Alice had come to get a glimpse of Lisette, to see her moving through her own world, so she could gain a sense of Lisette as a person, rather than as the simple, expendable cipher described by Marceline. It was just as well Lisette Perrot wasn't there. Heaven only knew what she might have done had she spotted Alice stalking her. Alice had left Evangeline and Marceline in Jackson Square. Evangeline kneeling before the child crone, grasping her small hands and explaining to her that they weren't going to allow any harm to come to Lisette Perrot, in much the same tone Daniel might have used to explain why a young Alice couldn't have ice cream for breakfast. Evangeline's admonition had fallen on deaf ears. Marceline had ignored her niece, looking over Evangeline's shoulder to regard Alice with a questioning gaze. A life for a life. That was the deal Fleur had made to save Lucy. And it was the same proposal the infernal creature was now offering her. A vague, perhaps paranoid suspicion began to gnaw at the edges of Alice's mind. Could Fleur have been influenced to resurrect Lucy for this very purpose, so that Alice might one day be given a sense of precedence? Lisette Perrot was a stranger to Alice, but Luke was family. Alice felt sure that to Marceline, the trade would seem irresistible. To have Luke return to them, flesh and blood and spirit, at the low cost of the erasure of a woman to whom Alice owed no loyalty. Alice had to hand it to Marceline. In many ways, her plan approached perfection. The witch had either been bestowed her current form as a powerless, pitiable child, perhaps as a joke or punishment, or burned through the last of her power to assume it. Her sisters were gone, reduced to ash. She was alone and helpless. In her present state, only a heart carved from stone could resist feeling at least a modicum of sympathy for her. Looking into the waif's eyes, it was almost possible to forget that Marceline and her sisters had conspired with Celestin to sacrifice a good portion of the region's witches. Almost. But Marceline was trying too hard to win Alice to her cause, with her composite message of, "You're special. You're powerful. You have been chosen." The subtext being that Alice could do as she wished without guilt or fear or recrimination. Marceline had lost all, but Alice could rebuild her family, rebuild her life. All it would take was murdering the woman who had defeated Celestin. The woman who had prevented Marceline and her sisters from collecting their due. Alice laughed, her laughter causing the spirit faces to spark briefly to life. Marceline had an agenda, no doubt about that. Only Alice wouldn't play her game. She wouldn't bring Luke back. For years, Alice had wondered what Luke would have become, considered who he might have been to her if he hadn't been murdered. Her heart had tried to whitewash his character, to smooth away his sharp edges by lingering on the outings to City Park and the zoo. But Luke, the big brother, was only a sliver of a more complicated man. Luke had been no innocent. He had allowed himself to get caught up in Celestin's scheme to humiliate and kill Nicholas.
related in equal measure to Celestin's search for the damnable, the Book of the Unwinding, and to his hunger for revenge against Nicholas for having wrested control of the Chanticleers from him. Luke had hungered for power and been willing to kill to get it. He'd wanted to be in control at all costs. He would have sacrificed her and Evangeline to be king, no question. He was just like Nicholas, and like Celestin, too. After all, blood will tell. 25.
Cette putain, Madame Jean, Marceline said, gazing up at the ceramic Cal Delmain placard affixed to the drab olive and cream two-story structure known as Madame Jean's Legacy, one of the few remaining examples of Louisiana Creole architecture in the quarter. The old witch had insisted on coming here after they parted ways with Alice, or rather, after Alice parted ways with them.
Elle n'a vu jamais existe de vrai.
Evangeline didn't respond, prompting, it seemed, Marceline to assume she hadn't understood.
She never existed, Madame Jean. They got the name from a story.
Marceline placed her palm flat against the lower floor's cream-colored masonry wall.
I used to know the name of the owner, the man who had all these old walls built, but now it's forgotten. Poof! Like so many other tidbits I've lost over the centuries. I do remember another house stood on this spot when my sisters and I first arrived here. The owner of the earlier house was a Francois Marin. She gave Evangeline a sly smile.
A relative? She said with a shrug. I won't avow one way or the other, but I will point out a portion of the original Marin house is said to have been incorporated into a second structure that was later built on this same spot. That interim building was almost completely destroyed by the Great Fire of 1788, but the remaining portion of it was, in turn, incorporated into the current structure. And this house survived the Great Fire of 1794 unscathed. It's almost as if a residual magic remained to protect the house, or at least the part of it that was once owned by a Marin.
It was kind of you to take me in, Marceline said, changing the subject abruptly and without taking her eyes off the house. I, a person you've long feared and despised, it was kind of you to feed me and give me shelter.
It was nothing, Evangeline said, though in fact it had taken a great effort to divorce the murderous witch from the needy child.
A nothing for which I once sold my soul.
You are, she said, looking back,
a kind woman. I'm sorry you're kind. It will make what is to come harder for you.
We aren't going to harm Lisette Perrot.
You reject action. You will watch many others die because of your inaction. Either way, blood will be on your hands. But you do have a choice as to how much.
Evangeline wanted to change the topic, and she jumped to the first question that came to mind. Why did you want to come here?
In truth, Marceline said, turning her attention back to Madame John's legacy. It was partly nostalgia. Visiting the square has left me feeling sentimental.
Yeah, public executions in pralines. Good times.
Why else? I wanted to make a point.
She went up on tiptoe and touched the plaque.
This house is old, ancient by the standards of this country, but before this house, there was another house here, one that stood for decades before my sisters and I arrived on these shores.
Yes?
You've long believed us to be the instigators of this little drama, the first cause of your unhappiness. But there were forces at work long before we left Europe. My sisters and I were mere links in a chain forged long ago. before we stumbled on frostbitten feet through frozen pines into a darkened veil. Perhaps even before this veil of tears. She raised a hand and gestured widely around the scene. Was fished out of the abyss. Poetic, but that doesn't absolve you of your sins. I'm not seeking absolution. She looked up at Evangeline, a crone's resolution showing through a child's eyes. At least not for myself. I only want to help ease your conscience when the time comes. I'm not going...
Oui, je sais, Marceline said. You won't lay a finger on la voodooine. I'm not speaking of la parole's demise. I'm speaking of the future and how one day you might look back and wonder if you should have done more. More to save me. More to save yourself.
She reached out her hand.
I know you brought it. Show it to me.
There was no reason for Evangeline to pretend she didn't know what her aunt was referring to. She slipped her finger into the too small pocket of her jeans and pulled out the chain her mother had forged. She held it up, contemplating its ugly medallion, engraved with markings that resembled bird tracks in sandy soil, and the open clasp that might as well be the fangs of a venomous snake. Evangeline held it out to Marceline, but she did not accept it. Instead, she took a step back. Evangeline felt an energy begin to pulse through her skin, and the necklace changed once again into the exquisite collection of emeralds and diamonds.
Polarities of the same energy, Marceline said again. What is special about these stones?
The diamonds are crystallized power. Why the emeralds are special is a bit more complicated. It begins with Thoth.
Thoth? The Egyptian god?
Yes, Thoth was a big shot. He was thought to have devised the calculations necessary to build the universe, and every science and art required for the creation of civilization. He was the god of writing, the creator of the sacred symbols that eventually developed into our modern alphabets. In the beginning was the word, after all. The occultists hold he created 12 tablets, but...
Wait, let me guess. There are really only 7?
Marceline nodded. Each tablet not only records one of the 7 principles of magic, but embodies that principle. All is mind. All is vibrational energy. There is no duality, only polarity. Between each polarity, a rhythm measures movement. In all matters, cause and effect are joined. Coincidence does not exist. The essential force manifests its polarities as gender. Feminine and masculine are in all. As above, so below. Each of these 7 principles is inscribed above its corresponding gate, engraved, if you will, above its proper wound. The 7 tablets are made of emerald. For centuries, occultists, alchemists, kabbalists, and magicians have devoted their entire lives to the search for the emerald tablets of Thoth. You hold those tablets in your hand now. They are the emeralds in that very necklace.
I'm sorry, I know at this point it must seem like I'm being obstinate, but I'm having a really hard time believing they were created by an ancient Egyptian god.
Marceline shrugged. Some claim Thoth wasn't a god, that he was a man.
That sounds a bit more... A man who escaped the destruction of Atlantis.
Wait. And death to become a god. She finished, then looked at Evangeline with an incredulity that likely matched her own.
With all you have experienced, is the thought of this Thoth personage achieving immortality and perhaps even divinity
so much to swallow? After all, this is exactly what the Dark Man is offering you. Fall as a witch, rise as a god.
Thanks, but no thanks.
You came into the world for this very moment. You may think you understand what motivates you and others, but I can assure you, there has always been a guiding hand. Even this necklace, she pointed at it. The massacre the night of Celestin's ball. Celestin put his scheme into play, believing himself to be its master. But the massacre had a hidden purpose. To create enough energy to reunite the two polarities of the necklace in the common world. If I hadn't asked you for the necklace, the Dark Man would have found another way, another unwitting accomplice.
This hidden agenda, what is it?
Marceline laughed. I can't speak to what is in the Dark Man's heart. It would be like a thought trying to describe the mind that holds it. He isn't of this world, but this world is of him. I play my role as given me, and you must do the same.
My queen, my whore,
Reverend Bill's voice called out from the end of the block.
Oh no, Evangeline said to herself. She pointed at him and called back.
Now is not the time, Bill.
But still the old man wove and wobbled along the sidewalk, coming closer. Marceline continued, as if a drunk weren't tottering along toward them.
You must accept your role as Queen Ma Chère. You must willingly put on the necklace Mireille's husband once forced on you.
The corner of her mouth curled up.
For it is written.
Written by whom?
Theodosius, of course. It was he who created the gospel.
You mean the Book of the Unwinding?
They are one, of course. Theodosius and the Dark Man.
Marceline continued as if she hadn't heard Evangeline's question.
The mad monk was how the Dark Man chose to incarnate himself in the common world. Once. He has come many times.
Marceline lowered her head as Reverend Bill drew near.
You recognized him once, the night of the massacre. When I helped trigger your first transformation, you sought him out. You flew to his side.
The old man in the dirty coat knelt before them, his shiny pate surrounded by a fringe of white hair like a monk's tonsure.
My queen, my whore.
He paused, looking up at her with wild eyes that had peered into the sea of absolute unbounded potentiality that lay beyond this reality. A flash of repressed memory flared up within her. As Celestin's ball descended into absolute chaos, she had caught hold of Hugo and carried him to safety. But then she'd carried on, rising up into the night sky, circling, drifting, then finally dropping down to alight at Bill's side. The old drunken street preacher had placed a gentle hand on her head. It had been his touch that changed her back to human form.
My daughter.
Your mother married to save herself from the Dark Man, but the man your mother married didn't sire you. Your mother already carried the Dark Man's seed in her. You can be the greatest Queen Malshea because you are his.
She crossed to Bill and placed a hand on his shoulder.
You must not trust your lover, this Boudreaux fellow. He came to you that night at the old amusement park for a purpose that had nothing to do with love. All of the Boudreaux are executioners. Had you chosen that night to claim the power that is rightfully yours, to accept your role as queen, he would have murdered you or died trying.
I don't believe you. Marceline gave a small shrug.
I never expected you to. Go ahead, then. Ask the man yourself.
The air around the two roiled. and Marceline and Reverend Bill, her aunt and her father, disappeared, folding back in on themselves until they were gone.